This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
5Live.
To find out more about 5Live and its sister service, 5Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.
Do the box office top 10. One of these 10, Matthew has seen, so he'll chip in with his instant review.
Please tell me it's Norbit.
No, I saw the trailer for Norbit, but that put me off.
I saw the poster for Norbit, and that put me off seeing the trailer.
It's offensive.
Yeah. It's Bannister, is it?
Bannister at bbc.co.uk.
If you want to join in this thing. So the box office top 10 this week, at 10, Material Girls.
Rubbish. Hilary Duff, I mean, you know, the name saying it all. But actually, Hilary Duff has been apparently okay in some things in the past, but
she's
this is...
great stuff.
Yeah, she has a very strong teen girl contingent, and that's absolutely fine, but she's not Anne Hathaway, and this is particularly poor.
Music and lyrics, 9.
Hugh Grant is better at being Hugh Grant than almost anyone else. Drew Barrymore just does that sort of doozy role which she falls very easily into, and it's nothing like as good as it ought to be because it ought to have a much better script.
Is doozy the same as ditzy?
I think ditzy and doozy would be not repetitious. I think they're slightly different inferences.
Charlotte's Web at number 8.
Inferences even. Charlotte's Web, it's again okay adaptation of a much, much better novel. It's a bit sub, babe. Your children may have a problem with the fact that it does deal with death, although I think it's perfectly all right that it does do. But it is a shame that it's such a timeless book, and it's just so flat on the screen. It's not a bad film, but it does reflect rather badly on the state of children's entertainment nowadays, that this is now what passes for superior children's entertainment. I mean, where is Mary Poppins? Where's The Sound of Music? Where's all the films that we remember as being really great children's films? Stop me if you've heard this one before.
Okay, yeah, we have.
Yeah, I know, but
if I stopped
it was
you
rhetorical when I said
If I stopped you every time we'd heard it before, we'd be over in 5 minutes.
A short programme.
The number 20... Oh, no, The Illusionist at 7.
Which, again, is a pretty good piece of work. I like Ed Norton. The problem with it is that it's post-prestige, and it does feel a little bit like, didn't we kind of do this once already? And it's not as good as The Prestige. I mean, it's a finely mounted thing, and I think that, you know, Edward Norton is almost always worth watching, except when he did that terrible Hannibal Lecter film. But other than that, he's fine.
Do you understand what happened at the end of The Prestige?
Yes.
Oh, good, excellent. I'm still trying to work that one out. I like The Illusionist, but we just didn't have that kind of sting in the tail.
No, but the fabulous thing about the end of The Prestige... Do you mean the denouement, or do you mean the end, or do you mean the...
The denouement, you know, yes. What was actually going on.
Is there a denouement before the end?
If it's... I'll tell you what, yes.
I know we're going to have this conversation who's going to mystify the rest of the
country. No, I can tell you...
Because we can't tell anybody what happens
All you need to know, without giving away the ending, and if you don't want to hear the ending, turn your ears away now.
Well, that's everybody.
No. I'm just saying. I'll tell you
on a note and pass it to Matthew.
Oh, it's fine. Well,
it's only Matthew wants to know.
This has now gone from being like a job interview to like being in a classroom. Write it on a note. If it's worth saying to anybody, it's worth saying to everybody.
Tell him afterwards.
All right.
And where were we?
And if you want to know what happened at the end of The Prestige, email us in and we'll have an email service which explains how it all works. It's perfectly straightforward, Matthew.
Oh, good.
You've spoiled it.
It's just for the hard of thinking like me.
You know, at the end of Citizen Kane, it's a sledge. At the end of The Crying Game, it turns out it's a bloke, right?
Okay? Steady. Right.
Then number 23 at number 6.
I mean, Joel Schumacher back on old form of all style and no substance. This desperately wants to be one of those thrillers that makes you think, oh, the number 23, it's really mysterious. It really has got... And it's like, no, it's like the Da Vinci Code. It's like, yeah, get on with it. I know, fine. That's it. And it's, you know... Shame.
Outlaw at number 5.
I have a real problem with Outlaw. Well, I have two real problems with it. The first is that I don't think it's a very good film. The second is I think it's politically obnoxious. I think it is... There was a point in the 1970s when making revenge thrillers was kind of seen to be okay. And Pauline Kael once very famously said about Straw Dogs that it had a fascist mentality. And I think Outlaw veers, worryingly close to exactly that. It's a film which basically says, you know what, the law can't deal with these people, so let's take them into our own hands. And it has a sort of a pretend morality about, hey, they're kind of corrupted by it. But in the end, it's a Nick Love film about a bunch of guys with a bunch of shooters going around and, you know, sorting things out. And you know what? It's not enough. And it's not very good. And Bob Hoskins is a bit naff. And Sean Bean should be in a better film than that. And the only really interesting thing about it is that the main psycho guy is played by the guy who played Ian Curtis in 24 Hour Party People. And he's just as mad in both films.
In contrast, Becoming Jane at number 4. Ghost Rider at 3.
Well, you know, Nick Cage turns into a skeleton and his head catches fire. The first time you see that, you think, actually, that's all right. The second time, it's like, yeah, I know.
Why would you see it a second time?
No, the first time you see the trick, not the first time. You wouldn't see the film a second time, unless, of course, you were James King, who, incidentally, I said to him, I saw him at a screening this week, and I said to Mayo last week, did you really like Ghost Rider? And he said yes. And James King said, I never said that.
He did.
Well, he said you're lying.
Well,
he said he didn't say that.
It's just outrageous.
There'll be a tape somewhere.
It will.
Hot Fuzz at number two.
I like it. It is 20 minutes too long. When they finally decide that they're just going to turn it into, you know, Straw Dogs meets the Vicar of Dibley, that is a problem. And they are having much too much fun with the shooters. But up until that point, there is 90 minutes of really good character comedy. I do like Simon Pegg, Nick Frost. I think the relationship they have on screen works really well. And I did laugh more than seven times, which means by my reckoning, it is a good comedy.
It's one joke.
It is one
joke. Elongated over a very, very long period of time.
But hang on, but did you laugh?
A couple of times early on, but then, you know, it just seemed to me to be so making the same point over and over again. I thought Timothy Dalton was quite nicely sinister in one of the parts, but it was only a couple of times. It was definitely wasn't a seven laugh.
Okay, well, I have to say, maybe. And I'm going to pull age rank on you here, Matthew. It's an age thing.
Is it?
It is, because believe me...
you shouldn't do that to me on my 50th
birthday. No, I know, but I'm just saying, it's funnier than two laughs. And every single person... I mean, believe me, I'm old anyway, you know, but...
Well, I did go with my 16-year-old son. I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah, well, there we go. Q and, if you will, ED.
Matt, I can't believe you're 50. Simon Bates was 34 for 10 years. I see no reason why you can't be 42.
I've been trying to pass myself off for 38 for a long time now.
Anyway, the box office...
too much into
65.
My short life.
The box office number one this week is... Oh, new entry at number one, it's Norbert.
Oh. You know, it is a funny thing, right? Because you have Al Gore, Inconvenient Truth, going on about the greatest problem, you know, the world faces at the moment is that the world is heating up and we're all going to die. And then you have economists who tell you that the greatest problem is that the economy is about to collapse. And then you have, you know, in the run-up to an election, each political party telling you the greatest threat to world peace is the other party. Almost the worst thing that's happening in the world at the moment is the fact that people are actually paying money to see Norbert. And I'm not saying this funnily or casually. I mean, I think it's really, really reflects appallingly badly on our society that people have actually shelled out. No, I'm serious. I'm not being funny about this. It's a disgusting film. It's a hideous, really disgusting, meat-headed mentality film that is just has a level of cruelty involved in it towards fat people that if you applied it to any other thing, if you applied it to race, if you applied it to sexuality, if you applied it to religious persuasion, you'd say this is totally unacceptable. This is totally unacceptable. And Eddie Murphy, who suddenly had this moment with Dreamgirls, he's got it all back. Suddenly he's reminded us of what talent he is, and then it's like, no, excuse me while I just set fire to my career again and kill all that goodwill with what is the most hateful, sleazy, nasty, and fundamentally not funny comedy. And if you've paid to see Norbit, look deep inside yourself. Look deep inside yourself.
Stop it now.
Take the same amount of money that you paid to see that movie and give it to a good cause. Because believe me, you're karmically unbalanced if you paid to see that film.
Bring up and defend yourself. 0500 909 693.
How can you tell if you're karmically unbalanced?
I don't know. Something
no, because say you paid £7 to see Norbit, then you're £7 in the deficit as far as, you know, moral all-rightness is concerned.
Liam in London says, is it the death of grotesque latex cinema as we know it?
Well, as I said before, the film Feeder, which I thought was the death of grotesque latex cinema, which was a really horrible, nasty, you know, sleazy thriller, was funnier than this. And that was a film in which, you know, a serial killer feeds his victims to death. And it's just repugnant.
Some people are now trying to defend the film Norbit.
I look forward to
and
it.
And in particular, this is a rather rude text, Mark.
Go ahead.
It says, Norbit was dead funny, you overpaid Ponzi critic.
Signed, E. Murphy.
This one says, I usually enjoy Mark's reviews, but he fails to realise sometimes that it's all opinion, and just because he didn't like Norbit and doesn't appreciate good humour, and then the text runs out. I think they were heading for a rant.
Of course,
and
it's all
this
opinion.
One, Jeff in Northern Ireland says, Norbit is hilarious. Comparing it to race and religion is wrong, as generally people who are overweight have only themselves to blame.
Well, you know, I'm not even going to touch. Pass me that 10-foot plague pole that I may not touch that text with it. Can I just say, incidentally, on the issue of opinion, yeah, of course it's opinion. The fact is, in this case, I'm right.
Reg.
Sorry, there we go.
Reg from Rottenstall, hello.
Hi.
Hello, Reg.
Hello. Mark Cornwell is absolutely right. I went last Saturday with my fiancée, I'm 48, and we walked out halfway through. But the reason I went to see it is that Mark put it down so much I thought it can't be possibly that bad, but he was right.
isn't the trouble with Mark is that he's having unnecessary consequences. His reviews are so entertaining that we all go and see the rubbish films he's slagging off.
No, but it is an astonishing thing. I think people are genuinely amazed by how, those few texts notwithstanding, are genuinely amazed by just how bad Norbert is. I'm thrilled to hear that you walked out. I think that's a great thing. I think, you know...
Is he karmically balanced then?
Yeah, I think that is. I think, you know, the point to do is to walk out, and as you walk out, Reg? Chef, I don't know what the rest of you are doing, but I'm leaving!
What did you not like about it, Reg?
Well, the pathetic list that he had on all the way through the film, and the comedy just wasn't that good. It wasn't funny.
You see, that's it. It's the nail on the head. Main problem with Norbit, all the politics aside, all the rest of it, it's just not funny. It's just not funny.
Okay, a couple of texts on this and then we can move on. Norbit, seen it, hated it, ashamed. Good. Somebody says.
Well done. You are forgiven.
I took my daughter to see Norbit. She has to repay me for putting me through that. Steve in Manchester, I have friends who get me free tickets for films, but I wouldn't watch Norbit if someone paid me. Tomo in Aberdeen, however, Norbit's hilarious. If you can't have a laugh at a fatty's expense, who can you laugh at? I don't want you to comment on that, okay. Mark. You've already mentioned barge poles and all that. Off you go, Simon.
You do realise that it's 22:12. We haven't reviewed a single film
yet. Let's do it.
We have already inflamed the nation.
James King sent a text, by the way.
Yeah, go on.
It's a misquote. I said it was fun for teenage bots.
Boys,
teenage
bots. It says
that's because he can't spell. You know, not only is he a child, but he's an illiterate child. Hello, James.
Just a quick one before what's the first review, by the way?
Premonition.
Okay, Clara says, Mark and Simon, I am Clara. I'm a philosophy student from Toronto. Been listening to your podcast for over a year. Having recently listened to them all over again, blimey. I have to say that, yes, Mark, you are always right, and in retrospect, I was wrong for ever disagreeing with you.
Good.
However, I'm writing to ask a favour. And Matthew, I'm sure you can help on this. I'm teaching some first-year philosophy tutorials at the University of Toronto. Since I found that the students learn the most when they are actually enjoying themselves, I've started showing them films to explain the salient features of whatever philosophy is under discussion. Next week we have the big existentialism lesson, and I was wondering whether you could suggest any films that would be do a good job illustrating what Sartre means by existence before essence, or how we must find our own purposes in life.
You lost me about halfway through there, but Michael...
Give you the perfect example of a film which would prove essence before existence, which is the other way around, and then you can maybe watch
it
back.
It's exactly the opposite of what she wants.
I know, but as you know, in philosophical terms, the opposites are almost exactly the same as the thing of which they are oppositional. And that's the ninth configuration, which may be called Twinkle Twinkle Killer Kane in your territory. Was it from Canada, that
thing? Yes.
Yeah, okay. Twinkle Twinkle Killer Kane.
Anyway, she says everyone's just been suggesting The Matrix, but it seems quite incomprehensible to me to use Keanu Reeves to teach anything more than, well, to teach anything.
No, but the point about The Matrix is, The Matrix is that kind of, you know, we are what we think we are, blah-de-blah-de-blah. But all Keanu Reeves has to do in it is walk around like a bloke who doesn't know what's going on, okay, which is why The Matrix works.
If there is a movie which explains Sartre and existentialism better...
I can tell you now that The Matrix is based on the work of a philosopher called Jean Baudrillard, who was a French philosopher,
yes,
who espoused hyper-reality. His book appears in the movie.
Jean-Paul Sartre...
Here comes a movie review.
Yeah, very quickly. Jean-Paul Sartre said, you know, that thing about, you know, you only...
What's that this week,
you
Mark?
Only exist because you know you exist. And Jean-Paul Sartre said that he didn't remember his mother giving birth to him, so therefore his mother hadn't. His mother told him that she did remember it, and she was quite cross. Anyway...
What's on this week, Mark?
The Premonition, the new movie, but it's so hard being a Sandra Bullock fan. You know, I really like Sandra Bullock. I met her once, I interviewed her, and she was really pleasant. And she started off with While You Were Sleeping, which is a great little movie, and then she did Speed, which is a great movie. And then she got famous enough to make her own decisions as to what kind of movies she wanted to make, and sadly she decided to make absolute pants from then on. So we had things like Hope Floats, which is rubbish, and Time to Kill, which is rubbish, and Miss Congeniality 2, and then there was a brief period when it all seemed to be coming back together again, because she co-produced Crash. She has a small role in Crash, which I love. It's great. And she's in Infamous, the film about Truman Capote, that's the other one, which got a great performance by Toby Jones in it. Before that, she made this thing, The Lake House, which is a time-travelling movie with Keanu Reeves, right? Fine. The story is they're living in a house together, but they're living in a different time. They can only speak to each other by passing letters through a TARDIS-like letterbox. Yeah? Fine? You with me so far?
I remember all this from last time.
Fine. So now, after the success of The Lake House, we have another sort of time-travelling movie, The Premonition. Sandra Bullock plays somebody who appears to be the perfect wife with a perfect life, wakes up one morning to discover that, oh no, her husband has been killed in a hideous car crash. Wakes up the next morning to discover that he hasn't, because it hasn't happened yet. She wakes up the next morning, he has again. On the fourth or fifth morning, she thinks, you know what, I think I better go and see a shrink. Sadly, the shrink turns out to be played by Peter Stormare. Now, if you are a movie fan or a cult movie fan, you will know that whenever Peter Stormare turns up, things are not going to end well. And it's funny, because you spend about 45 minutes movie thinking, yeah, go on, go on, it's going to be okay, it's going to work out all right. Basically, all time-travelling movies have one central premise, which is that knowledge of the thing in the future is the thing that causes the thing in the future to happen. This is a sort of structure which is worked, it's the butterfly effect, okay, worked over and over and over again. Okay, that if you travel around in time, your time-travelling affects the path of the thing. And the classic example of this, which are premonition movies, is Don't Look Now, right? The great Don't Look Now, in which the reason that Donald Sutherland comes to a tragic end is that he has a premonition that he's going to come to a tragic end, and as a result of it, and it's beautifully tied up, and it's absolutely marvellous, and it's Nick Rosemary, it's one of the greatest British movies ever made. Don't Look Now, on the one hand, on this hand, you know, don't look, don't bother, because sadly, what happens is you get this sense that actually this may be an interesting film, it may be an interesting way of doing a take, and then it's not an interesting film, it's just that other rubbish Sandra Bullock sub Hitchcockian, sub-supernatural, boring, turgid nonsense that she keeps making. And it's a real shame. She's accompanied by her husband, who came on the Mayo Show. What's, you know, your man from Nip Tuck?
Yeah.
What's his name?
Yeah, that's right.
Him.
He was on.
Complete plank.
Julian McManus.
There may be a rule that says that nobody is allowed to be on screen with Sandra Bullock who may actually overshadow Sandra Bullock. And certainly nobody on screen in The Premonition comes anywhere near to it. And she's not even very charismatic in the central role. The worst thing about it is that there is central to the plot a car crash involving a huge truck. And you think, pass me the keys to that huge truck so I can drive it through the holes in the plot. Why didn't somebody just sit down and go, hang about a minute? There's one point when Sandra Bullock sits down and she starts plotting out the timeline of her life so she can figure out how all the days fit together. And you can see her doing it on the screen. And you're thinking, yeah, I can see this thing. And I can already see that it doesn't work and it doesn't make sense. And your reaction on day three doesn't match up with your reaction on day one. And I know how it's going to end. And please surprise me. Oh, no, it's exactly the same film. Premonition, yes, we all knew what it was going to be like before we went in. Sadly, it turned out to be exactly that. Please, Sandra Bullock, make a decent film, because it's so hard to be a Sandra Bullock fan.
This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
More chance to do some reviews.
Yes, some listeners' correspondence for our next one. This is from Chris, who's a film lecturer in Edinburgh. The Matrix isn't based on Jean Baudrillard. It's a cheap studio intellectual load of tosh that actually ends up saying the exact opposite. Don't use it to teach. Martin in Bournemouth, Double Indemnity. The original, of course, is good for showing Sartre's views on existence and authenticity. Stephen, there's a whole number of Pan's Labyrinth emails because it's come out on DVD.
And you're not going to mention them.
Well, I'm just going to mention this one. I've recently received, says Stephen, from a Greek female warrior delivery company, a 3-disc set of Guillermo del Toro's Pan's Labyrinth, Devil's Backbone and Kronos.
Yeah.
I've never seen any of this fine chap's work. In which order would you advise me seeing these films?
Well, actually, in that reverse, okay, Kronos first, because that's the kind of, that's the protean slime from which all of his stuff comes. Then you need to see Devil's Backbone before you see Pan's Labyrinth, because Devil's Backbone is the sort of the brother movie to Pan's Labyrinth, which is, you know, a more feminine take, I think. And I think that way it makes sense. So we'll go Kronos, then Devil's Backbone, then Pan's Labyrinth. Also, you're kind of you're working up the hill there, and you're ending with, you know, with the fabulous Pan's Labyrinth.
Right, and we'll do some more on that next week. But if you don't go and see Premonition, is there anything else that might catch up?
Factory Girl, which has, you know, got headlines probably for all the wrong reasons. The story about Edie Sedgwick, who was for a while Andy Warhol's muse, and then wasn't Andy Warhol's muse anymore, and sort of came to a inevitably tragic end. There have been many films about Andy Warhol and the factory lot, and what one feels about Andy Warhol is obviously open to debate. I mean, I think some of his stuff is okay and some of it I think is a bit airheaded. But in the case of Edie Sedgwick, I mean, it's a difficult thing for the producers, isn't it? Edie Sedgwick, like, we need somebody who's going to play basically a sort of airheaded, not particularly talented, thin sort of, you know, coat hanger who famous for turning up at premieres and looking glamorous and famous for having a ding-dong with other people who are more famous and more talented than her. Sienna Miller busy, do you think? And, you know, along comes Sienna Miller, who's had a bit of a rough ride in the past, because, frankly, she hasn't been any good in the past. And this may be the one role for which Sienna Miller is perfect, because, you know, she does a perfectly passable performance as Edie Sedgwick. It's a very, very, you know, annoying characterisation to some extent, because all those people who are around the factory, you know, obviously people will know this already, but the background is 1960s Andy Warhol's factory, in which he decided to produce a whole lot of mass-produced art, whether it was screen prints or whether it was music to some extent with the Velvet Underground and Nico, or whether it was movies, and he made a lot of movies. He started out making them himself. After a while, he realised that he couldn't direct movies, so he ended up handing all that over to Paul Morrissey, and most of the stuff which is really great Warhol stuff is actually Morrissey's stuff. But in the middle of it all, is the story of Edie Sedgwick. Now, there was a great big fuss when they were making this movie because Bob Dylan's lawyers got involved, rather ill-advisedly, I have to say, because according to Bob Dylan's lawyers, an early version of the script had somehow implicated Bob Dylan in Edie Sedgwick's tragic demise. And they said, this is terrible, this is wrong, it's totally misleading, blah, 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 blah. So what finally happened in the end is that you have a character on the screen who looks like Bob Dylan, sounds like Bob Dylan, is actually called the folk singer, in the credits is referred to as Billy Quinn, and is never... But and nobody ever says, you know, you're not going to get very far, Billy, because you look and sound exactly like Bob Dylan. But to compound the insult, he's played by Anakin Skywalker. So, it's Lying. Hayden Christensen comes along, you know, once upon a time, you drank no fun, but you don't know the power of the dark side. Look, and the thing that Sienna Miller got into the most trouble for was when the movie premiered in, I think it was New York, she turned up in... You saw this with the photographs of her in her tights, right? And everyone said, oh, terrible fashion disaster. She turned up in her tights. Well, no, the point about that was what Edie Sedgwick, you know, walked around a lot wearing tights. That was the thing. And it was actually, funnily enough, it was one thing for which it was completely forgivable. Also, it drew a lot of attention to the movie. And the movie's actually not bad. I mean, it's directed by George Hinkelipper, who's a perfectly good director, best known to some extent for the Apocalypse Now documentary Hearts of Darkness. But he also made a really good film called The Killing Box some time ago. And it's perfectly well done. It's got a great central performance by Guy Pearce as Andy Warhol. I mean, a lot of people have done Warhol on screen, including, most famously, David Bowie, who just basically did David Bowie in a wig. And everyone said, oh, that must be Andy Warhol. But Guy Pearce is great. He's got a real sort of reptilian quality to him. And he does, I think, do Warhol as a complete creep, which I think there is an argument for doing him like that. He has this kind of strange, completely sort of socially removed sense that he doesn't care about anybody, doesn't care about anything. He's just got a couple of ideas that are quite nice. But, you know, but beyond that, he's not really much more than the image of himself. And as many people have pointed out anyway, all you ever saw of Warhol was an image projected. You never knew what the inner self was like. I think he does a great performance. I think Sienna Miller acquits herself perfectly fine, cheap gags aside, because she has been terrible in the past. Cheap gags aside, she's perfectly good. And oddly enough, Hayden Christensen as Billy Quince.
Pete Seeger.
As Pete Seeger, exactly, for reasons which are entirely legal. You know, once you get over the gag of saying, I'm just really sorry, I don't think I'll ever be able to listen to, you know, any Bob Dylan record again without imagining he's about to whip out a lightsaber and, you know, duel to the death with Ewan McGregor, he's all right. I mean, he's not the greatest actor in the world, but he's a pretty boy, and under the circumstances, he serves the drama well. It's not particularly insightful, but it's not as bad as it sounds like it ought to be. And there are moments in it in which it's pretty good, and Guy Pearce, I think, is absolutely great.
On the subject of Hot Fuzz, which came up earlier, because Matthew didn't like it because he's old, and Mark did like it
because he's young. Not that
no,
old.
No, quite not, he's not quite that
Marianne
old.
Marianne says, I'm 51, my husband is 50, we took our three teenagers to see Hot Fuzz. We all thought it was brilliant, then adds, mind you, we are doctors. I'm not sure that that's necessarily shedding any light.
There's youth and qualification come into play here, doesn't
Andy,
it?
On this, I'm going to see 300 next week. Should I be giddy about the film, or will the good doctor crush my excitement and tell me it's utter tosh? Just in a sentence.
If you have any adolescence, take it with you.
That'll do, and more detail next week, hopefully, otherwise it'll be a bit of a dull show.
No, but you said you didn't want any more than that. You said, I just wanted to see that. I mean, I can give you more, but you said you don't want it now.
Well, it's a couple of minutes. It's Matthew's programme. Time for another one, though.
I'll do very quickly, Fur, an imaginary portrait of Deanne Arbus, right? Deanne Arbus.
Say that again?
Fur, colon, an imaginary portrait of Deanne Arbus.
Don't see movie with a colon in. It's not going to be a good
one. Well, let me read you the opening. You know Deanne Arbus, famous photographer, okay? Fine? Mm-hmm. Again, and at the beginning of the movie, it says this. This is a direct quote. I don't even have to review the movie. I'll just tell you the direct quote at the beginning. What you are about to see is a tribute to Deanne, a film that invents characters and situations that reach beyond reality to express what might have been Arbus's inner experience on her extraordinary path. And the imaginary journey is, she lives in an apartment block, and upstairs is Robert Downey Jr. as a Wookiee. And that's basically how Deanne Arbus became to be the extraordinary photographic talent that we all knew and loved. And you know, on a directorial level, it's very strange because everyone always says that Deanne Arbus' photographs inspired David Lynch movies, and it does look like Stephen Shainbook, who made the much better Secretary, really wants to be David Lynch because he keeps focusing on plumbing. And plumbing, as we know, is David Lynch's domain. But it is a movie in which Robert Downey Jr. is the hairy guy upstairs. Nicole Kidman is just quite annoying, doing that Nicole Kidman suffering artist thing that she did in The Hours. Remember in The Hours she had the stick-on nose, right? Yeah. Well, in this she just does this, you know, I am Nicole Kidman. If I just don't move very much, occasionally flutter my eyelids, everyone will think I'm really... And the role was originally going to go to Samantha Morton, who I think would have given it much more oomph. But it was just like... No, it's Nicole Kidman in a frock doing the thing with Robert Downey Jr. and the Wookiee, and I learn nothing about Deanne Arbus's photographs from it.
It's been fantastic to have you on the show, gentlemen. Thank you very much. I did want to ask you a personal question, Mark, because you come on this show and you come on Simon's show every week and review the films. You're very, very outspoken and very opinionated. Are you like that at home? Do we know if somebody puts a plate of food in front of you? Do you go, well, you know, I love the broccoli, but unfortunately, I'm really, really fed up with the way the potatoes have been cooked.
No, he's not in charge at home.
Let me allow Simon to answer that question.
His wife's in charge.
Oh, really?
Absolutely.
So there's somebody more outspoken and opinionated at home than Mark?
Yes. Well, Mark is married to the probably the only woman who's an expert on soft pornography, and when he goes home, that's what he has to watch, because that's what his wife watches.
Sounds like potentially a treat. This from Angela. Please, please, please. Let me know what happens at the end of The Prestige. I don't think we should do that. Do you, Mark?
No, I'll email you. If she sent in an email address...
She sent a text.
Right, I'll text it back.
Oh, you don't know how to text.
No, I don't. I can tell you can do it.
We'll help you with it.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.